I am a walker. I love walking. I'm one of those obnoxious people that will be down on the mall in Washington, D.C. and be like, let's just walk from the Capitol to the Washington Monument. It's no problem. And this week, I was lucky enough to have some time to take a walk down a country road in Maryland. It was a place in the middle of Civil War country, not so much unlike here, a place of landscape and memory still scarred by old battlefields and those sloping fortifications and long-forgotten patches of grass where long-forgotten soldiers breathed their last. This particular country road was remote enough that I swear in a walk of an hour and a half's duration, I saw one vehicle, which was the mailman making his rounds. It was, you know how the weather has been these last few days? It was blustery, and it was beautiful and windy in a way just dramatic enough to make one pensive and thoughtful. On such a day, it's hard not to get lost in your thoughts. So as I walked along, stuck in thoughts of time and landscape and history, I saw something truly astonishing up ahead of me. It was cresting the nearest and highest hill in the surrounding area, and peeking out from behind a grove of barren trees, there was what seemed to me to be a mighty fortification holding down the high ground on that hill, overlooking everything below. It was like a ring fort, or an ancient temple, or a crumbling coliseum looming over top of everything else there, you know, commanding a place of power. It held its defenses against all possible comers down that road, which at that moment consisted entirely of me, the mail truck, and two crows. And looking upon it, I marveled at the enormous size of the blocks that made up this thing. My head started spinning, like, where did they quarry those stones around here? And how did they get them up that hill like that? And how many feet do you think they had to go at a time before they rested? And I kept walking, and I thought surely there would any moment be a historical marker provided to give me some context for what I was seeing. Maybe there were tourists somewhere and I was just on the wrong road. Maybe I had missed the guideposts, because clearly this place was something significant. Those stones looked old and worn, settled into the land. And as I kept walking and wondering, finally I turned down the tiny side road that led to the castle on the hill, and the stand of trees parted their skeletal arms so that I could just begin to really see what I was approaching. It was a mighty fortification indeed, a ring of large, powerful, beautiful hay bales. What I had mistaken for monumental architecture was simply the yield of last summer's hayfield, rolled and bare and baled and stored up on top of the hill from which it had grown. What I had mistaken for a castle was actually cattle feed. And where I thought I gazed upon fixed history, there stood these beautiful forms that rose up from the land around them. You see, when the horses get hungry this year, one by one, the stones of my massive fortification are going to get rolled down that hill and become a part of the process of eating and living and dying and growth. What I thought was forever was only the briefest season, impermanence masquerading as solidity. How often do all of us mistake hay bales for castles? In our own lives, mistake a moving thing, an organic thing, something changeable with an unchanging edifice that shall never move. That afternoon, it was my eyes that deceived me. but so too do our hearts, convincing us that whatever is before us in our lives is a solid form, an unmoving force, a given for all time, until clarity and proximity shift our gaze, and we finally see that what we have been hanging on to as fact for all these years is just a hay bale on a hill, there for a season, ready to succumb to the family of things, to be a part of something grander than itself. All of us have, at one time or another, mistaken impermanence for permanence. All of us have been too long deceived, and that which we hold on to, that which we try to convince ourselves is forever, is sometimes the very essence of our own identity. We attach ourselves to activities, to concepts, to ways of being, as if they have never and can never move in the slightest, lest we forget who we are in this world. We hold on to concepts of who we are, to what we believe, sometimes long after those concepts have ceased altogether to be useful. The word attachment comes from an old French word, attache, which means nailed to. So to hold on to an image, an idea, to ascribe to it a degree of permanence that it does not really have, is to nail oneself to it, to make it the burden you must bear. Gerald May, who was a psychiatrist and a spiritual director for many years at the Shalem Institute, which is in Bethesda, and is a wonderful center of spiritual learning. He wrote this book, Addiction and Grace, Love and Spirituality in Healing Addictions. And he speaks of our almost desperate desire to ascribe permanence to our own behaviors. He speaks of that as a particularly insidious form of addiction. Even good things, even seemingly the best parts of ourselves, he says, if they are clung to, can become the chains that bind us and hold us back from becoming who and what we are called to do and to be and do in this world. As he says, I am not being flippant when I say that most of us suffer from addiction, nor am I reducing the meaning of addiction. I mean, in all truth, that the psychological, spiritual, and neurological dynamics of addiction are at work in almost every human being. The same processes that are responsible for addiction to alcohol and narcotics are also responsible for addiction to ideas, work, relationships, power, moods, fantasies, an endless variety of things. Addictions, you see, are not limited to substances. We may also be addicted to being liked, helping others, good performance, responsibility, intimacy, an almost endless list of behaviors. We are all addicts. Moreover, our addictions are our worst enemies. They enslave us with chains that are not of our own making and that are yet paradoxically quite outside of our control. To dial it back and come to our original story that we began this service with, Tanzan and Akito, the Buddhist monks, they meet this woman on the side of the river. Tanzan picks her up and he carries her across and he puts her down before moving on, but it is Akito, the one who never raised a finger, who carries the greatest burden of all. The burden he carries is the fixed, unmoving judgments of a man whose rigid boundaries have shaped his whole identity. It is not appropriate for a celibate monk to touch a single woman, let alone lift her in his arms and carry her. Akito is living his values. He is holding tightly to a vow. And paradoxically, it is that unyielding vow, that inability to set aside one's rigid promise in exchange for a moment of simple compassion that becomes his undoing. He carries that woman much further than his willing friend, and his attachment causes him more suffering than could ever happen by lifting one across a stream. Such stories move in the faith traditions of the entire world. There is this powerful image in Mark chapter 9 where the disciples are walking along this road, and they're walking to Capernaum, which particularly in the Gospel of Mark is kind of like the disciples' home base. They go and touch base there, and then they go out and they do their thing. And as they're walking down this road toward Capernaum, the disciples had been out, you know, doing disciple-y stuff. They're healing, they're preaching, they're feeding the hungry. And their footsteps were inevitably leading them toward Jerusalem, where Jesus has already hinted to all of them that what waits for them is a confrontation with the powers of empire that they will not all survive. Basically, what's happening is that the disciples are walking along on their last night at home before they step willingly into the jaws of danger. They are walking away from safety, and this is their last chance to be together and be safe before the difficult days ahead. And as they are walking along toward Capernaum, the story says that the disciples proceed to get in a great big fight. Not about how to proceed into this danger or the hard choices they will have to make in the face of empire. What they get in a big fight about is which among them is the greatest. Like, who healed more lepers, or who cast out more demons, whose sermons were more finely crafted, or like who listened to Jesus better or tied his sandals the tightest. It doesn't matter. The point is that as these men faced down death, all they could talk about was which one of them was cooler. And so there they are, bickering and waving their hands in the air and scowling at each other. And when finally the fight is done, Jesus comes into the mix and says essentially, "What in God's name are you people talking about?" He wonders, "Don't you get it? Don't you get it even now that none of this matters? That all of your ambitions and your petty power struggles, all of your desire to get ahead of one another and attachment to your pride of place is nothing after all that you have seen, after all that you go toward? Don't you people get it yet?" And the sad thing is that we do not get it. More often than not, we hold on to our attachments even after we have peered through the trees and seen that they are not made of stone but of softer stuff. We hold on because letting go would mean admitting that not just our surroundings have changed but that we ourselves have been changed as well. Nothing is permanent, not even your pride. Nothing is permanent. Not even your promises. Nothing is permanent, least of all your life. And if we are going to have the courage to fight for our lives, there are a few things we may have to let go of first. In the words of Joseph Campbell, we must be willing to let go of the life we have planned so as to accept the life that is waiting for us. I would go one step further to say that we must be willing to forgo our entire sense of self if we are ever going to accept the self that the world is waiting for us to become. Nothing will ever be the same as this moment. Nothing will ever be the same as it was before any given moment in any of our lives. Nothing will ever be the same as it was before your divorce, your diagnosis, her death, your loss, this love, this breath, this moment. Nothing will ever be the same again. And holding on to an image of what was is like trying to build a castle out of hay. Or passing a woman by the river because your promises outweigh her need, or spending your last night among friends fighting about who is better. None of it matters compared to right now, to who you are, and to who you yet will be. My friend Marjorie Bankson is, among a great many other things, a clay artist. She's a potter. And some years ago, she was driving actually to go teach a class in clay artwork to people in a different state, and her entire car, like the whole trunk of her car, was full of raw blocks of porcelain clay. And as she was driving to this place, she got a call that a dear friend of hers had been in a car accident and would soon die. And so she turned her car around, and she drove, figuring that those people can learn pottery another day. She drove to her friend's bedside, where he had already slipped into a coma from which he would never recover. She sat and she watched the machines ticking away the last moments of his life. This friend of hers who had been a spiritual companion through 20 years of deepening and fellowship. And his family started to gather around, many of whom stood in varying degrees of estrangement to the man. They gathered around. They prayed and they talked. They did what you do at a bedside. They wept. Some of them found themselves curiously dry-eyed, even in the face of it all. And when it looked like the time had truly come, a member of the family asked my friend Marjorie, the potter, the clay artist, if she would be willing to make a vessel to hold her friend's ashes. Something from her own hands to mark his passing, they thought would be appropriate. And of course, she said, yes, of course, yes. It would be her great honor to use her talents in this way. And then it hit her that she had a car full of clay and no kiln. No way to fire it, no way to glaze it, no way to bake it hard so it could last forever and hold him in its eternal silence and never let go. She had no way to make that raw clay a permanent thing. And then she realized it didn't matter if she had a kiln. It didn't matter if the clay got fired. It didn't matter if that raw clay stayed raw, unglazed, unbaked, fragile, and susceptible to something as small as a drop of water. It didn't matter, for her friend was gone, and the clay would in time be gone to a fragile being in the embrace of a fragile vessel. And so she made him a pot from raw clay. She formed it with her hands. And since her friend had always loved to go crabbing on the Chesapeake, they took his ashes in this fragile, breakable urn out on a little boat into the bay, and they let him go. And in no time at all, that unfired clay would melt away underneath the waves, returning to the earth from which it came, a part of the natural cycle of living and dying and living again. That clay would commingle with the ashes, which in turn intermix with the water, and no part of any of them would be divisible from any other part. It didn't have to last forever. It didn't have to go on unchanging, because unchanging fortresses of stone have never been the way of human life. And today, my friend Marjorie makes unfired burial urns for her friends and for the members of her church when they die. They are too fragile to be shipped. She can't put them in a box. She has to deliver them with her own two hands. It is a final act of love to enfold the earthly remains of people she loves with impermanence, to say goodbye and really mean it. To let go, and not so much let God as let life and its endless flow move through all things, including ourselves. Nothing will ever be the same again. That fortress atop a hill will give way in short order to another season's abundance. Even your deepest hopes will change. And it is well. Letting go, it is well. Mm-hmm.